Like, what's it like? Is it like people from different states in America, but more severe?
It's like a Texan talking to a Californian.
But is it more intense than that? Is it deeper?
Yes.
Yes.
Hey, guys, and welcome to The State of It. I'm here in spirit with Dad and Jason Miller. Jason is the host of Miller's Military Moments and is a veteran of 20 years. Jason, it's great to have you here with us today, and thanks for being here and taking the time to join us. How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Really am. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's great to share, you know, parts of my story and have some great conversations with y'all. So thanks for having me.
Brilliant. And Dad, how about you? How are you feeling today?
Tip top. Enjoyed our preliminary conversation with Jason before we even got going. And we're going to have a great call, I know.
Jason, could you tell us a bit about yourself, your military credentials, and your time in Afghanistan?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So just recently retired from 20 years in the United States Army. Been aviation my whole career as a Black Hawk helicopter crew chief and maintainer. So I joined the Army right before 9/11 happened. So in 2001 in July, I actually was a high school English teacher. Before I joined the Army. So I was teaching high school and left to go join the Army. And then 6 weeks into basic training, 9/11 happened. And so obviously turned the world upside down pretty quickly. But, you know, so became, you know, was trained as a Black Hawk helicopter mechanic and reported to Fort Hood in 2002. Have multiple deployments, 2 years in Iraq, spent 2 years in Afghanistan, spent a year in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, all with Army Aviation and the Black Hawks. And every deployment was different. Everyone was different. The missions were different. The places were different. Op tempo was different. So always dealing with different challenges through there. And particular in Afghanistan. So I spent one of my rotations was out west in Shindan near the Iranian border. And then that was in 13-14. And then another rotation was in the eastern portion in Jalalabad, which that was the 16-17 deployment. So
how many years did you spend in Afghanistan in total?
Total 18 months. So 2 9-month rotations.
Well, that's a lot more than Dad and I. So you've definitely got the resume. So focusing purely on military aims, has the Afghanistan war been successful or unsuccessful, Jason, in your opinion?
In my opinion, it's been successful. Successful in that our mission was to not prevent or not allow Al-Qaeda, a safe haven, to conduct attacks or intelligence on us or our Western allies. So in that regard, it is a success. We accomplished that probably within the first couple of years. The Taliban is a political organization. It was the government at the time. Yes, they were housing them. And so we did have to, you know, fight with them in order to try to get, you know, Al-Qaeda and then Al-Qaeda out of there and not allow them to have a safe haven. And of course, you know, we wanted the mastermind of the attacks from 9/11, which took us a few years to get, which that's another part of the discussion because, you know, he was in Pakistan. He was in Pakistan pretty early on, we're pretty sure. So, and there's, you know, obviously being in a different country and we're not in conflict with them creates difficulty. So, but in short, really, we accomplished our mission. It was successful. Did we need to be there for 20 years? Probably not, in my opinion.
And Dad, what do you think? What are your thoughts on what Jason has said? And what are your thoughts on the success of the war?
So I have friends who were out there from the beginning, you know, right in the early interactions and also been out there since. And I think it's an interesting, we've got to go back to the mindset of 2001 and 9/11. And that was the neoconservative construct that America had won the Cold War, that democracy would dominate the world, and the neocons had this concept where they would export democracy wherever the opportunity came. So there was a twist from 9/11, which was not just to stop terrorism, but to actually encourage and spread the flow of democracy towards three regimes that were difficult. One was Iran, you know, one was seeking nuclear weapons. The other was North Korea seeking nuclear weapons. And that problem and the threat was also Iraq. So there's a bigger construct to look at here, where that agenda was taken as, how do we stop the development of weapons of mass destruction? We all know it was an artificial construct that anything but chemical weapons would have been built in Iraq. That was just an excuse, which is hollow. We also know that in the distraction of going to Iraq and Afghanistan, the third element became a nuclear power underneath the radar screen, which is North Korea. Massive failure in terms of the initial goal of preventing weapons of mass destruction. The next bit that's really relevant, and I agree with you, going in there early and making sure that, you know, Al-Qaeda originally didn't have a home to operate from was a mission critical process. And obviously there's, in that process, there's a sense of mission creep where you turn up. And essentially now you realize that actually you've got to occupy the high ground, otherwise they'll come back. And essentially that mission creep just kept creeping as something else happened. And that was, this wasn't an asymmetric war in favor of the West. This is the interesting thing about asymmetry. Asymmetry comes from technology or demographics. And demographics and expanding demographics mean that the opposition in a guerrilla-type conflict can afford casualty ratios higher than the ones that you're involved with, even when you drop down, you know, your casualty ratio through high technology. So time was never in our favor by hanging out in Afghanistan. It was always, always going to eke away at us. But what's interesting about it then started to overlap another major problem, a bigger problem by a major degree. And I always argue that the real threat to Western hegemony came from China, shorter and faster than we ever imagined. And that if we got distracted by the so-called Islamic threat, that if you're really honest about it, as horrendous as 9/11 was, as, you know, terrible, it's smaller, but, you know, our event in 2007, the truth is it could never really change our way of life. It could irritate us. It could produce fear to a safe society. But you're looking at the eradication of our society when it comes to China. And the biggest failure was we faced a smokescreen. And the smokescreen drew us in. And our army, especially in the West, became an asymmetric army rather than a total war power projection machine. Ultimately, that's the hugest downside. And then that overlaps to another real problem, why I would disagree about the withdrawal. And that withdrawal means that there's a thing they call a pilot war. And a pilot war is when a hegemonic power fails to manifest its interests, which then encourages the hegemonic challenge to go to war. And I'll give some examples to put it in perspective. The Boer War was a disaster for the British Empire because it encouraged the Kaiser that if the British army couldn't deal with a bunch of ragtag farmers running around on horses, it had to be an empire in decay. And he accelerated his military challenge, which consummated itself in 1914 and World War I. The Spanish Civil War was equally the same in Europe, the failure of Western powers to intervene. The Rhineland invasion and the reoccupation was a failure by France that encouraged aggression from Hitler. And the Falklands War is intriguing because that little old colonial war that people go, shucks, what was that about? That completely changed the mindset in the Kremlin that the West was weak, of a power which had nuclear weapons and was a cornerstone in terms of in Europe. That was a positive pilot war that prevented the Cold War from going hot. And I'm now going to classify Afghanistan as a terrible pilot war gone wrong, because we're about to see, like we did in Vietnam, the collapse of what was left very quickly of Afghanistan, which could have been prevented with 2,500 troops left in situ and $2.5 billion of spend, teeny compared to the increased spending we're going to need to hold the Chinese back. And so it's, if you look at the loss of money and treasure, but most importantly, the future encouragement of Chinese perception of American power, it is disastrous how we recently pulled out. And no, we didn't plan to be there, but we ended up being there, and therefore pulling out at the end saying, well, we didn't plan to be there, and then leaving a bigger problem isn't strategically wise. And I think Biden's drive to do that, despite his advisors and allies' views to the contrary, is a terrifying prospect, as he is perceived to be now a very weak leader when it comes to deterring Chinese and Russian aggression.
So are you saying that Afghanistan as a pilot war that we have now lost and that we should not be pulling out yet?
We should never have pulled that last vestige out. Absolutely. We should have sat there and just maintained it. I know that, you know, there were creepage and all the other things, but if we just maintained the status quo, the perception of weakness wouldn't have been as bad as it really is. Now we're about to see Saigon all over again, and that is going to just only encourage an incredibly aggressive Xi, who in all probability gave us the pandemic in the first place. Sorry, my cat always wants to get into conversations about Biden.
Well, Afghanistan is known as a graveyard of empires. Russia failed there. The British Empire went there. They couldn't take it. They failed. This war's been going on for 20 years now, and it seems like there wasn't going to be really a different conclusion. Jason, what do you think? Do you think that now is the time to pull out? Do you think we should be pulling out?
So it's really interesting when we look at the overall picture, and especially with the mission creep and the impact of the Chinese, and because I agree, the Chinese are really who we have dropped the ball and not focused enough on. And, you know, when they really, they've put it out there in public on what their long-term plans are, and we have not paid enough attention. And I've seen a couple of things that they've done in Afghanistan, especially up north, when they built a train coming in there, and it carried nothing, but it came every 24 hours exactly. And they're just waiting. They were just biding their time and waiting for us to leave. So that the Chinese, it's a big part of the world that we are definitely not understanding or not paying enough attention to how our actions in Afghanistan and elsewhere, you know, make us appear. And so conventionally, I believe we should have pulled out. And whether conventionally, I just mean standard troops, if we can, you know, support them through some of our special forces, our Green Berets, which are typically trainers of foreign militaries, and produce more, I know, locally trained, and it's pretty tough because the tribal aspect of Afghanistan is something no empire has ever figured out, and which is why it's almost unconquerable. They will never really belong to or believe in a central national government. They are so tribal in their areas that every now and then they may combine a little bit. But if we could have, you know, maybe left some unconventional forces to maintain the status quo, as David mentioned, there's a possibility of maybe us not looking as weak and not giving the Chinese and the Russians more confidence in our weakness, then, you know, maybe we could have done that. But for us on this side particularly, we needed to bring our conventional forces out. But, you know, we can look at the other issue. So when we failed, our intelligence services failed miserably in the 90s and right up to 2001. And, you know, we need to make sure that we don't fail in that manner again. And we saw a lot of signs back then, especially when we can look, you know, in hindsight, 2020, of what was going on. But with Pakistan not being really an ally, that was a big hindrance.
Well, the SAS funded Al-Qaeda, really. We all know that. You know, right. The SAS in Pakistan, they were right up to it with Islamic nationalism projecting through to that process. So were the Saudis. Allies were basically behaving, you know, in a completely subversive manner.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, especially when we look at, that's where that mission creep comes in. How far, you know, do we just keep, you know, do we cross the border in Afghanistan, who has nuclear weapons, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of challenges. So, you know, it's not necessarily, and again, I'll just shorten this up. I mean, yeah, the conventional forces needed to come out, but we could have maybe still supported. And who knows, we still may be there a little bit with our unconventional.
The trouble is, I think, you know, that indication of collapse has just created such a bolding of the Taliban. You'd have to go and put so many more troops in just to push the status quo back. It's too late. I think we're going to, you know, you look at Kandahar, it's gone. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another issue, which is part of an empire. And so one of the qualities of an empire is, dare I say it, the moral imperative to rule. And prior to 9/11, America had a moral imperative. It basically, you know, how it acted underneath, but on the surface, it had a moral code that appeared to be superior to people around it. And then, of course, along came Rumsfeld and Cheney, and their biggest destructive legacy was the destruction of that moral imperative with rendition and torture. All the things on black sites that, you know, were not American became American. And I always think it's really interesting when, you know, if you were to be, let's just say we were the terrorists on those airplanes and we could look back on our life, they changed the course of the American empire. Not just by the death they caused, but by its loss of moral imperative, by the way it responded. That was their greatest success. They shaped the enemy into the beast they claimed it was, rather than actually gave it and just left it on the moral high ground and just dashed against the rocks. The same moral imperative has been lost again by the withdrawal, because for the people of Afghanistan, what a terrible conundrum for them. Do I trust the Americans? Do I believe they're going to stay? You know, do I put my family at risk by becoming the interpreter? Do I, you know, all of those things that make America a trusted ally. And we've been through a Trump period when Trump severed many of those ties with close allies. And the problem is the only way we're going to contain China is by strong alliances based on trust. And sadly, one of the great legacies in Afghanistan is you can trust America when it's there until it's not, and then you're left on your own. And that's one of the other huge legacies of a failed pilot war, at a time when those alliances and coherence are required to hold back the Chinese expansive process. And I think we're not talking about 10 years or 15 years. A book I've just written really talks about it. I think we will be at war within 5 years. The Chinese have an accelerated program, way faster than we give it credit for, and not fighting a war that our conventional forces expect, using missile technology to clear the seas. And once they've cleared the seas, then they can pick us off individually. So we've got some really difficult things ahead. And US Space Command is the only capability to stop that if you can interdict the ballistic missiles that fly through space on their targets. So we've got this fascinating cat and the mouse game. But in terms of alliances, that's really a concern. You know, do people trust America to, but Japan is very vulnerable to China because it has not taken on board nuclear weapons. It requires on America's umbrella to use nuclear weapons. So if I was sitting in, you know, in Xi's Politburo, I'd say, you know, I reckon we should try that weak spot. If we go and nuke the Japanese, and we go and then threaten every American, you know, from Guam outwards with retaliation, will the Americans actually put their own population on the line for Japan? And we know full well that the construct of the European Cold War required France and Britain to have its own nuclear weapons, which would just cascade the whole war off sufficiently that America never had that choice. But now more than ever, I think that doubt and that seeded doubt creates strategic vulnerability. So the knock-on effects, I think, are just huge. You know, and that's why I think a token force to maintain the status quo would have been the smart move, not this, you know, singular pullout by Biden against all his advisors' wishes.
Dad, earlier you mentioned collapse. Collapse leads to a vacuum. And then what fills a vacuum? In Afghanistan, NATO and the US have pulled out because of the collapse of the war or the withdrawal. How or if... And how then, if they do, will Russia and China fill the vacuum in Afghanistan? Will it be conventionally? Will it be through influence? What do you think, Dad?
Well, one of my theses, even when we were involved in Iraq and Afghanistan in this, you know, battling inverted commas against Islamic fundamentalism, is that just as Christianity and the Islamic world combined when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, because communism is a godless pursuit. In fact, China is no different. And so I think you might find the Islamic nations bonding with the Western nations against the godless Chinese, inverted commas, which means the Chinese might not get the traction that we may fear inside Afghanistan, because we are talking about religious zealots, but they may well buy their way in sufficiently to look like it. The Russians, well, their legacy is probably the least friendly of all, you know, apart from the Kalashnikovs they all use.
So I think it might be
hard for that process. What's that, Winnie?
Saying that's quite fresh in the minds of Russian expansion.
Yeah, it is. So it is. There are plenty of Russian minefields that children get blown up on to remind them of that. So, and there's tanks all over the place. So I think it's unlikely to be filled as swiftly as we might fear. Its damage is from another source, which is we've withdrawn. and broken our covenants.
Jason, what do you think? What about this vacuum? Who's going to fill it and how is it going to be filled?
Well, I think China is going to fill some of that vacuum in Afghanistan, but I think your dad's right with not necessarily like with people. It's going to be their traditional way of how they've been doing it in Africa, whereas they're going to bring in the cheap money. Yeah, I think they're going to continue to bring in that cheap money and then, you know, give them that money for, you know, infrastructure, because they have a lot of earth minerals that are really critical, and especially to the Western lithium batteries and almost everything we use. So, and then of course the payback terms will not be great. They won't be able to make them, and the Chinese will kind of end up owning them. I think
good
that's the
colonialism and the Taliban and then turn on them too, right?
right, absolutely. I think besides those, the minerals and some of that stuff, that's really what the Chinese want. They need resources. They need resources bad, which is, you know, part of their expansion into the South China Sea, which we have given them the green light by, you know, we've called them out a couple times and then we've never stopped them. They've called our bluff and they've lied to the world and we just let them keep going. So, yeah, I think that's how they're going to fill the vacuum, but their eye is the South China Sea and then pushing east, you know, further. And it's the Philippines because of the resources. You know, we can almost, well, let's look in the World War II and you see the Japanese, the reason they went west, they needed resources. They, you know, many people in that part of the world, I mean, they need the resources to fund and to build their war machine. So,
and you're exactly right. I mean, you know, people say to me, why do people fight wars? Quite simply over resources. Expanding demographics demand more resources, industrialization, and systems in ascension always do that. The Chinese have a little slight problem in that they are vulnerable to U.S. naval blockades in the current protocol. If they swept the U.S. Navy aside with DF-21s and 26s fired en masse, then it becomes their sea. And before that, the Belt and Road strategy that people miss, and yes, it's about power projection, but the truth is it's about power. It's about resourcing across land routes that don't go through the routes controlled by the U.S. Navy. And so Afghanistan is interesting, although difficult to access because of the mountain passes, because it circumvents that process. So I think you're dead right about it being an objective on a map if they could do it. And I think the Taliban will use them until, you know, that changes. So that it's a sort of interesting balance that we'll wait and see what happens. But I do feel for the population of a country now left to the most extreme subjection of rules, beheadings, tortures, children, girls not educated who were brought up with that expectation. It's a human tragedy on the most vast scale.
If there are resources there, as you're saying, then why are the US and NATO not staying to harness those resources or to help the Afghanis?
Because they got shot in the process of doing it. It became impossible to actually extract them because the people were so truculent.
So surely that'll be as difficult with the next power that comes along to try and take what they have.
Well, it depends how much money the Chinese pay them initially, I suppose, as Jason correctly says. There will be an awful moment when no amount of money, it means they can get their resources out. But I think that there are other places they can go to more easily than there. But most importantly, it's a PR relationship plus. If the Chinese move into an area where the Americans pull out, that sends just a massive message of who's next.
Moving on to the actual pullout strategy from Afghanistan. On the 2nd of July, US forces left Bagram Airfield without telling the Afghani commander in the middle of the night and left behind vehicles, ammunition, and weapons. Is this indicative of an overall US strategy with poor communication upon exit and leaving things behind to try and get out of the country? Jason, what do you think?
Well, I'm upset about it, and I would... Okay, what it shows is that we didn't trust our internal allies, the Afghans. That's exactly what it shows. And that bothers me. And a lot of those people, we have been by our side the whole time we've been there. And we owed them much better. Listen, we can withdraw from that country, you know, in a timely manner, slower or faster, In other words, we didn't need to do it overnight like that. And we didn't need to not tell them, you know, listen, we do have billions of dollars worth of equipment in that country. And because it's landlocked, we essentially have to get everything out by air. A lot of the roadways that we tried early in the war going through Pakistan to one of their ports, a couple of their ports, most of the convoys never made it and they got, you know, robbed and pilfered. While on the surface, it probably saved us some money. Who cares? I mean, look, listen, we waste money like it's not even funny. So in this particular instance, let's take our time. Let's be smart about it. Let's take care of our Afghan partners. Definitely a lot better than what we just did and showed, which really goes back to what David was saying with that trust. Can America be trusted?
It does seem a bit harsh, doesn't it? Yeah, it does seem a little bit harsh. Dad, what do you think?
Well, also, Jason's spot on. It's about the dignity of a hegemon taking its time to extract itself. And it's about the trust in the relationships you have. And it sort of demonstrates an impetuousness. Biden wants everyone out, so you just leave. And with it, a complete loss of strategic perspective, which again goes back into, if I'm America's enemy, I'm sitting there thinking, this guy has no idea about strategy, no idea how to execute, and I'll find his weakness and I'll drive a wedge through it.
So are you saying that the exit strategy is a result of Biden himself and the rush to get out?
This is pretty unique. Biden drove this despite everyone around him, his allies, his advisors telling him not to do it. This is his singular responsibility of change. And with it, you see a hallmark of the president of the United States, which I think to Xi's eyes will look like weakness on steroids. He must be doing a jig every night.
So Jason, having served there and having served alongside, you know, some of these people, how do you think they feel watching their longtime allies kind of go out in the middle of the night on them?
They feel betrayed, left alone, angry.
All the good thoughts.
Right.
All the
That's
happy
exactly
thoughts.
How they feel.
And they have every right. And if you're an ally of America, I mean, in Britain, everyone says we've got the same rep because we can't stay there if America doesn't stay there. So it's not just America's rep, which just went down the Swanee. It's basically anyone that was supporting the allied causes. And let's be honest, it was fundamentally driven by America, has got more egg on their face than you can find in an egg pudding.
Did you just make that up? That's not a saying, surely.
No, I mean, it's a very serious issue. I mean, we had a big debate here about not enough of the interpreters who supported our forces were brought over. And we had this reticence to bring these poor guys who had committed themselves to one side and were left dangling with their families and vulnerable, which I think is quite disgusting in terms of the whole process in Britain. And if I went to another country and America and Britain turned up again, I'd run a mile rather than actually be involved in the whole process after this.
Yeah, I definitely, that's absolutely another thing that upsets me. Anybody that was an interpreter, assisted us, anything, listen, we know the Taliban is going to kill them, okay? Yeah,
and their families, everyone related to them, and they're going to butcher them in front of it. It's just,
right.
So in effect, once you've brought people into your circle of trust, when you abandon them, this is the most heinous breach of that covenant.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you think Biden is aware of what's happening here? And do you think he's aware of these effects that it will have on people who he's or have been fighting alongside America for such a long time? Or do you think he just doesn't care? Jason?
I don't think he knows. I don't think he understands. And some of it is, I'm not going to say that I think he definitely, you know, he has a lot of cognitive issues. I'm not going to go there in this discussion, but I don't think, I mean, he's been a politician for so long that I really, besides trying to listen to his advisors, I don't think he's listening to them. He might be hearing them, but he's not listening to them. And so he is under so much pressure domestically right now. And I'm going to go back a little bit to the Clinton years when Bill Clinton was under so much pressure during his impeachment trial. We basically lost. We had an opportunity to take out bin Laden at the time. But he didn't have the political clout to do it because he had so many domestic problems he was going through. In our country right now, that's where Biden is. He has fumbled the foreign policy issues from day one. But even besides that, he's under so much pressure right now from his own party internally to make a lot of really isolationist changes, which even though they claim to not want to be isolationists, but really try to, you know, bring a lot of money and support into our own country and certain areas of our people, that he doesn't have the political clout to do anything else. So
I agree with you. I think there's another aspect here, which I'm always fascinated by. Human beings tend to see other people as they see themselves. So when you get an autocratic, expansive state, a Democrat or a liberal, as we call them in the UK, will tend not to see the real nature of that nation and leader, but actually just project their own values onto them and assume they're the same. And therein is the opportunity. So World War One, and in my book, Lands Led by Lands, I think Lloyd George was singly responsible for the outbreak of World War One by signaling to Germany that Britain wouldn't come to France's aid. And as a significant member of the opposition, the Germans chose to believe that, and therefore they rolled into Belgium. That's a liberal triggering a war by the perception that they were a peacenik. In the same way, Clinton, you could argue, failed to understand the nature of China and like bowled into getting them into the world construct, was completely had the wool pulled over his eyes in terms of their intentions to subvert American investment to build the biggest manufacturing base and then turn it back on America. That started with Clinton's delusion. And so right now, this piece about the Democrats always tend to face internally towards social injustice and ignore the boundaries of the empire. And this time there's a big monster sitting on the boundary. They are highly responsible for encouraging that autocratic aggression. So it takes two. It takes the aggressor and it takes the perception of weakness. And I'm daring to say in Western societies, liberalism and the Democrats are very responsible for those weaknesses. Very responsible.
I agree.
And on that happy note, let's move a little along to some improvements to Afghanistan. So 2 decades later, what has been improved, or have there been any improvements, Jason? What do you think? I'm talking more humanitarian and social, necessarily, not necessarily military.
Well, okay. While we're there, the social aspect, the people could choose how they wanted to live. Okay. While we were there.
So there was some increased freedom.
Yes, for the most part, right? Unless their villages and their village elders and their tribal elders decided they wanted to still wear the burqas and whatever the case was. But for the most part, yes, they had freedom of movement. The girls went to school. You know, they could wear whatever they wanted to. A lot of people started to get that freedom of choice. They could vote. They're just as corrupt as any other nation trying to vote. But so there definitely were some improvements in those areas. Some of the areas that were not really improved, and 20 years is kind of a short time frame when we look at, I'll just call it nation building, but is some of the basic infrastructures. And, you know, Afghanistan, infrastructure wise, is like 1,000 years ago. It's still so far behind that even with our technology assistance in money, you just can't go drop $5 billion and it creates, you know, water systems that can really reach, you know, 1 million people, and electricity power grids. And then the eastern part of their country is really mountains with bowls. It's with bowls of people. And so to connect them is so difficult. So they're, while inside those bowls, we probably did some good infrastructure wise. Again, it's up for them to maintain it, which they're not going to do. The Taliban's going to take it all back down. So really, I think the best parts of, you know, making it better was giving the people a chance to see what freedom looks like internally, to make their own choices, to get educated, stuff like that.
So I think that's the cruelest.
Dad, just very quickly, what Jason said about the improvements. I actually got some facts and figures here. So 3.3 million girls are now in education in Afghanistan compared to 9,000 in 1999, and women now hold 20% or 27% of seats in parliament compared to 0% before the war. So there have definitely been some social improvements. Dad, do you think that these improvements are in danger of being eradicated following the withdrawal?
Completely reversed. And so, and I think that's a really sad thing about it, is that we forget how long it took Britain and America with our versions of democracy to work through, you know, various strange habits and replace them with what we call democracy, tolerance, integration.
Hundreds of years.
And as you said, Jason, 20 years is short for nation building. But there was a serious sign that women, as a part of their society, a migration to secularism, the expectation that there would be some kind of education away from Stone Age thought processes, all of those things were on the route. And I think, you know, no, they're not even close to where we would have in our society. But there were hallmarks of this that we could, it would have been really great if we could have just left the legacy where it was and at least had something. But the advent of the Taliban is going to wipe all of that out, because they cannot afford to educate their population because they'll have a revolt. So you know, it's a return to the dark ages and a cleansing of a 20-year slate, which is a credit in some ways to the one byproduct of us in the West being there, all removed. And I think that's terrible on a national level, but the individual tragedy for those 3 million women that were educated, the members of parliament, all of which probably won't even survive the experience, because leaving educated women peppered around Taliban society
not going to go
isn't
very
really
well.
Going to be helpful for their cause. So I think it's a tragedy unfolding in front of our eyes, and we are responsible for it, sadly.
Yeah, I would agree. And just on a similar but side note with my experiences in Iraq and Egypt. So with being in the, you know, the Muslim Islamic world, you know, for several years, they are, you know, before we got the printing press, you know, fire and brimstone, all we knew is whatever our religious leaders would say, and they would teach us, this is what the good book says. And so we would follow them. And as you're alluding to, knowledge is power. So they don't want, you know, any women to have that knowledge, because then, you know, becomes power and they can, you know, talk intelligently and make decisions. Much of that world over there is still in that thought process. They don't, you know, even a lot of those countries, they don't want their, you know, women or certain people to be educated at all. And they just want them to rely on their religious leaders, which is, you know, creates some fanaticism.
There's a place in the world where, in look at Turkey, which, you know, under Ataturk became a completely secular society. And you see that influence trying to reverse it. But there you've got generations of people who are educated who at some level, you know, persist. And it's far from as extreme in terms of the changes made, even though it feels oppressive to those people who are subject to them. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we'll look back in a year and the Taliban will rule Afghanistan and God knows how many people have died and a dark cloud has descended upon the whole population. And I think there is shame for us in the West to be responsible for that process. Great shame.
I think I was doing some research for this and I found an interview that I think Sky did of an official Taliban spokesperson called Sahail Shaheen. And he has claimed that improvements to women's rights and improvements to social structures will not be reversed under the Taliban. But I've got to say, I think that's very doubtful. And I think women in those areas that the Taliban controlled are failing. Jason, earlier you mentioned tribalism in Afghanistan. Can you equate that to anything in Western society that we might understand, not having been to Afghanistan ourselves? Like, what's it like? Is it like people from different states in America, but more severe?
It's like a Texan talking to a Californian.
But is it, yes. Is it more intense than that? Is it deeper?
Yes.
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 In what way?
So the analogy is correct. The comparison is correct. So if you know, for those that, you know the breakdown of the states, and there's different states, it is absolutely just like the people of Texas talking to the people of California, and they're next to each other. Let's just say they're next to each other. But it is definitely on a more intense scale. So everybody within Texas is extremely deathly loyal to everybody within their border. They may trade, they may be somewhat friendly to the other people, but they will always put their own people first, and which is what, you know, makes it difficult to, you know, belong to a central government there, because let's just say Texas may say, no, we don't want to belong. We don't believe what Washington, D.C. is saying. You know, we're going to do our own thing. And then California wants to be a part of them. And then, you know, they may end up actually fighting over it. And so that is what it's like over there.
And Jason, the best analogy is a southern state versus a northern state pre-Civil War. You've been there in America. It's exactly the same. 200 years later for America, and you know that was an accelerated industrialized change. And one of the things that happens in the Civil War is you do finally get mixing. You get, you know, finally breaks the barriers down. It's one of these horrible human experiences that creates a winner that then, you know, took Grant bloody two terms to somehow reintegrate America, and took, you know, many more decades beyond that. And strange enough, Southern values actually predominated in many ways, even though they lost the war. And you know, so, I mean, Ulysses Grant is one of my great heroes, one of a remarkable man. And his vision for America took, you know, 70 years before it started to show through. So these social changes take a long time.
I think that, you know, the idea of nation building, like you've both said earlier in this podcast, and the idea that it takes time. I think a lot of people seem to expect a massive change in Afghanistan in a very short period of time, and it's just not necessarily realistic. But anyway, Dad, you just mentioned a civil war, and a civil war seems to be looming in the future of the people of Afghanistan right now. And the idea behind another massive conflict, and this year has actually seen the highest civilian death toll in years in Afghanistan. So I ask you both, Jason, you first. In 5 years' time, what do you think Afghanistan is going to look like?
I don't know. I'm going to go 1 year time. One year time, the Taliban will be in control. They will be back in control. Maybe they won't reverse all the things like they said. Maybe they will. My guess is that they will. Just my guess. Just from historically who they are, you know, dealing with them, I understand, because they have to rule by fear. Like that's how they keep, you know, again, I'm going to go back to the Stone Age, you know, pre-printing press. They got to rule by fear. So they're going to whack everybody and kill everybody and keep everybody in the dark. So in a year from now, I think that's what it's going to be. Civil war is happening right now with, so the local Afghan government, let's assume we're all out and we're not doing anything right now. Well, they are fighting for their own country essentially right now. So it depends on how much do they want to fight? How many people are they willing to die to try to stop the Taliban in their own civil war? Now, you know, pre 9/11, we were still trying to run guns in there. We were trying to, but we had no human intelligence, no boots on the ground prior to 9/11 when the Taliban came in, which was a huge intelligence failure on our part. Now we know through history that that's one of our, the Western side, our biggest game plans. You know, we like to run guns. We use our intelligence agencies to try to support, you know, the side that we want to support. And, you know, shoot, we left them a whole bunch of equipment and stuff, but it's a year from now, the Taliban will, if not sooner, will be in control. And then 5 years could be the Chinese inadvertently, but not visually. Okay. But yeah.
Dad, what do you think? Let's go 1 year and then 5 years. What's your prediction?
I think Afghanistan's government will collapse quicker than we ever imagined, just like it happened in Saigon. The speed at which they're being swamped and the people are panicking and the conventional Afghan army are defecting is huge. And when it comes down to conflict like this, is about intention. The Taliban have been hardened by having the shit kicked out of them by America and its allies, and they know their business. The Afghan army has been on the right side and has had relatively, you know, highly supported combat experience with America behind it and firepower. So I think this thing will roll up faster than we ever imagine. And, you know, and it's, as Jason said, it's going to be a Taliban-controlled nation. I think it's going to have serious echoes of the ISIS state that finally galvanized the West into removing them with its cruelty and behaviors. And somewhere in it, the Chinese will try. But I think that, you know, the Taliban will try and take the Chinese for a ride. The Chinese will try and take the Taliban for a ride. In that respect, they'd be very well matched. And, you know, what happens afterwards, sadly, as a human experience, is going to be appalling. And we in the West value life. We claim to value life, freedom, and we have perpetrated a horrendous slaughter and subsequent suppression, and we're responsible for that. So I think that the kickback that's going to come to our politicians and the sense of national shame that we echo as we realize what we've really done, I think that's the untold price that is still that we will pay in the West.
Well, I think that's a nice place to end it, guys. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. And Dad, thank you so much for joining us as well. It's been lovely.
Jason, it's been a serious pleasure. You're the first guest on our three-way host, and you've been a treasure. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And thank you all for inviting me. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a great time. Thank you.
It's been brilliant. We'll think of something else to do. And we did a great job, okay?
David Murren specializes in using the past to predict the future, and is an accomplished public speaker, hedge fund manager, and market trader. To date, he's authored three books, Breaking the Code of History, Lions Led by Lions, and Now or Never. His fourth, The Road to Wars, is due to come out in 2021. He also writes a blog on his website, www.davidmerrin.co.uk, where you can find more on his life, views, and work.